I got a sobriety date of August 10th, 2012. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor. He knows he's my sponsor. And I'm grateful that I'm aware that I have the disease of alcoholism. You know, that is some important information for me. I don't know. I picked up my first felony at 13, and it was off and running. You know, as soon as I got the privilege to hang out till the streetlights came on, you know, I was out causing trouble. And I caused trouble all the way till I stumbled in here at 25. And, you know, I've been in and out of jail, and, you know, I hurt a lot of people, you know, in that short amount of time. You know, I remember, you know, a couple incidences where, you know, my mom, you know, I was a minor and I was in and out of jail a lot. And, you know, having my mom and who I know now, her sponsor at the time, come into the police department to pick me up. And I just remember the look on her face. You know, it was terrible. And, you know, that look continued, you know, throughout my drinking career. And, you know, I don't know. You know, something happens to me, you know, once I take a drink. You know, I get thirstier. You know, I cannot stop. You know, and, you know, they slap the cuffs on me pretty quick. And, you know, I continue to try to get loaded in jail, you know. And I don't know, I got released you know, from West Valley Detention Center on, you know, August 9th, 2012. And, you know, by this time mom had a restraining order on me, so my sister came and picked me up from county jail, and she made sure, you know, that I was going to get into a place, you know, because I signed a contract with the county of San Bernardino saying I had 30 days to check myself into a rehab. If not, I was going to prison. And, you know, when I was in that courtroom, you know, I had to think real hard about that, you know, like, you know, 6 months in a rehab or, you know, 2 years in prison. You know, those were hard terms to come to. But, you know, so thank God for my sister. You know, she made sure that I went in somewhere safe. And the first place we went to was Salvation Army in San Bernardino, and they said we were full. And you know, this is like before we went there, this is a real important part of my story too. You know, I had manipulated her into getting like a hotel room where I knew I can, you know, get the thing that I needed to get in order to feel better. You know, so we get a hotel room out in Ontario. As soon as we get done with dinner, I go into the room and I call the connection, right? And he pulls up, and like, this was my plan. I was gonna get something, and I was gonna take off. That's what I do. And for whatever reason, you know, God intervened that night, you know, and you know, my sister comes barreling out of the hotel room, screaming and hollering, and for whatever reason, my buddy looks over at me and says, "You know what? I can't do this anymore. I can't serve you anymore. You know, you need to go get help." And, you know, you're in a pretty bad spot, right, when the connection tells you that, right? And, you know, so I reached into a center console, and I drank that 32-ounce of Bud Ice as fast as I could, as quick as I could, because I didn't want to feel the way I was feeling, you know? And that's what guided me my entire life, right? These feelings and emotions, right? They made me make decisions based on feelings that, you know, hurt people, hurt myself. And, you know, it's insane. So so we went to San Bernardino, they were full. And then, you know, I was like, all right, screw it. You know, it ain't gonna happen. Right. So my sister like conned me into getting in the car. Right. She's like, "Oh, hey, I gotta go pick up my check in Pasadena. I'm gonna take you out to lunch." She knows I'm a sucker for food, you know? So I get into the car and we get off the freeway and I see Salvation Army in Pasadena, right? And, you know, so I ended up in there, and I was always in trouble there. You know, it's a 6-month program. The first 30 days you're in there, you get a nice little red lanyard with your name tag, and, you know, you're on restriction, no phone, no internet, no nothing. And, you know, after that 30 days, you're supposed to get a nice bright green one. And, you know, I had a yellow one. The yellow's for the troublemakers. You know, and I think I had that yellow one for like 4 months straight. Why they didn't ask me to leave, I don't know. But I had a vital spiritual experience in that facility. I remember I was working in the kitchen, and it was a long night. And I remember going to my room and not being able, like my body being physically exhausted, but I couldn't shut my head off. You know, and, you know, I know that, you know, the book talks about like a spiritual experience, how it happens slowly over a period of time. And I believe that night was my first vital spiritual experience. And it was the first time in my life that I asked something outside of myself for some help. And it kind of went like, I don't know what's going on, but I can't keep living like this. You know, and, you know, the lights didn't flicker. Or lightning outside didn't happen. It was nothing magical like that. But I remember I went from like throwing pots and pans around in the kitchen just to kind of being a little more mellow, and things started to get a little easier. And you know, I graduated that program, and you know, still with an active restraining order. And so I started looking at sober livings, and I ended up in a sober living in Chino. Wow, the two guys running that facility are no longer with us, but you know, they were very instrumental in my early recovery, and you know, they were the get in the car type of guys, you know, and you know, we ran around Chino doing AA. You know, I started going to the meeting, got a little job, got a little car, you know, things started happening, right? And the one thing that I know about Alcoholics Anonymous is, you know, I come in here, I quit drinking, my life gets good, right? You know, all the bad stuff, you know, stops happening because I'm not making decisions while I'm intoxicated. But when I start hanging around people that have the same goal, and I start working some steps, and, you know, I start doing the right thing for the right reason, like, it starts building this momentum. And, you know, God just keeps throwing stuff at me. You know, and, you know, I got my own little place, and I moved out into a place with this dude that was in the sober living. And, you know, he ended up getting loaded. So I made the phone call, and I said, hey, I need to come back to sober living. You know, and I went back in there, and the owner of that sober living says, you know what, we'll make you assistant manager. You don't have to pay any rent. Save up some money and get yourself a little place. And then I got hooked up with the young people out here in Covina, and we started traveling all over the western side of the United States doing conferences, young people's events hosted in Reno, Sacramento, Texas. Like, we just got in the car and went, you know. And, you know, when I stumbled into Covina, I met some people that became family. You know, and Rob's one of them. You know, if you would have told me before I got sober that I would have the life I have today, I'd tell you you're full of crap. Like, there's no way a guy like me can have what I have. You know, and, you know, I used to go to Rob. We used to have a meeting at Rob's house on Monday night. And the excuse was, is I would go show up early to help him cook. But the truth is I would show up early to hang out with his kid. Right? And you know, me and that kid built a bond, you know. And he loves me every time I see him up until this day. He's gotten a lot bigger now, but you know, that's the type of stuff that Alcoholics Anonymous gives for a guy like me, you know, is the ability to form you know, good relationships with other human beings. So I don't know, I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and now you get to hear from Rob.
Thank you, Danny. My name is Rob, I'm alcoholic.
Hey, Rob.
Well, after listening to Danny right here, he's not listening to me, but after listening to Danny, we could pretty much go home. He absolutely told the story of Alcoholics Anonymous, told us a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, you know. And and I can promise you, my son is 10. And we had the meeting at my house from the day he was born until right when COVID hit. And that's when we stopped having it at my house. And and all those guys that would come to the house every week, right? My son misses them, you know, because that's Danny B, right? Danny used to sit on the floor and play cards with him and do all that kind of stuff. See, because in my family, we do Alcoholics Anonymous, and we have a huge family, and I appreciate you. And when I walked up and saw you, there was no doubt when Les said, "Hey, did you bring somebody?" I was like, "Yeah, I brought Danny," right? Good thing he was here, right? So let's get right into this. I didn't start drinking or doing anything like that until I was 8. I held off a little bit, right? Wanted to make sure that's what we really wanted to do. And thank you very much for giving me the whole rundown on having this thing taped. Your list will probably be short tonight, so you don't got to worry about that. He tried to threaten me and say, you know, Les was going to send it to my sponsor, and I was like, the man knows everything about me, right? He knows everything about me, and I don't have to worry about that. So, you know, so at 8 years old, I wish I could tell you that at 8 years old, I knew a program called Alcoholics Anonymous was one day going to save my life. But at 8 years old, I had no idea about that, right? And at 8 years old, I wasn't picking and choosing. And at 8 years old, I had just moved with my dad. Prior to that, my parents got divorced when I was like 6 months old, right? And everyone always says things like, "Oh my God, you know, my parents got divorced. I really wish they'd get back together. I cannot imagine these two people ever being married, right? They are like total opposites, right? And obviously, they were both trying to upset their parents because they were polar opposites, right? So I never had that guilt like it was my fault, right? And I grew up with my mom, right? Until I was 8 years old, I lived with my mom. My mom was one of those biker moms, right? I knew that because she had the tattoo right here, you know, the number one Harley tattoo right there. So I knew she was legitimate. And for me, you know, growing up in that kind of life means that I really grew up at my Grammy's house, right? I lived at my grandparents' house most of the time. And my mom would show up after she was out on a bike run or something, and she usually showed up with my new dad. And she'd introduce him to me, you know, it's like your new dad, right? And that's not even a joke, it's the truth. You know, so it was like, it was a crazy life. Everything was really wild, right? And my Grammy, she was my stability, right? I'm a young kid, she was my stability, she was everything, right? My granddad would leave and go off to work, and it was me and Grammy, and she made sure that Robbie was okay. Right. And my mom had this wild idea that she was going to move. Her and my new dad at the time were going to move to Oklahoma because California and the South Bay was their problem. Right. So they up and packed up and moved to Oklahoma, and they opened a bar, which was a great thing for two active alcoholics to do. They opened up like a redneck Indian bar. Right. Like, yeah, no sense. But so they opened up this bar. Right. And I pretty much lived above the bar. We had a trailer out in the, you know, out in the boondocks that we like to call it a ranch, but really it was a single wide trailer. But most of the time I lived above the bar. And one morning my stepdad came up stairs and he had blood all over his face, and my mom was like, "Oh my God, what happened?" And he said, "You don't remember?" And she said, "No." He said, "Last night we got in a fight and you hit me with a bar stool and you busted open my head." And my mom was in a blackout at the time and had no idea. Had no idea that that had happened. And my dad, who lived in West Covina, heard about the situation and called her and said, "I think it's time Robbie comes and lives with me." And so at 8 years old, I moved from living above a bar into like a family. And when I say a family, I mean they wanted to do weird things like eat dinner together. And during dinner, they wanted to do even crazier things like have conversation. And my dad would ask questions that just really threw a kid like me off. Like, "So son, how was your day?" Right? Because no one had asked me anything like that for a very long time. See, and I felt absolutely uncomfortable. And Clancy used to talk about that invisible spring inside your gut. Right? And when I first heard him say it, I didn't understand what he meant. But I had that invisible spring as an 8-year-old kid, and prior too, right? You know, when your house burns down and all, you know, I had that spring watching my mom get beat up by some of these men, all that stuff. And I just was not up, and I was a little kid. There was nothing I could do about it, right? See, at 8 years old, I moved with my dad, and now it's a totally different thing, right? Like, everything is weird. And that spring continued to tighten up. And I had to walk to the bus, and I'm walking to the bus over in West Covina, and there's some kids that lived up the street that were about my age, and they were walking to the bus, too. And apparently their brother smoked a lot of weed, so they stole some from him. And they were like, hey, do you want some? Right? Like, I didn't hear. I was like, yeah. Right? I didn't hear him say, hey, do you want to spend your young adulthood locked up? I didn't hear him say, hey, do you want your family not to trust you? I didn't hear him say, you know, any of that stuff. Hey, do you one day, hopefully some program will save your life. I didn't hear him say none of that. Right? What I heard him say is, hey, man, do you want to fit in? And I needed relief. And it wasn't even about what I was doing. It was just about, right? And you hear people in Alcoholics Anonymous talk all the time about that first one. And I just felt, oh. And I don't ever remember walking to the bus and going, oh. I remember walking to the bus going, wow. Right? But, you know, it is what it is, right? See, but I had an absolute mental change. Right? At eight years old. Now, I'm not going to tell you I turned into a heroin addict at 10. And, you know, I none of that kind of stuff. You know, I was rolling up papers acting like there was weed in it just to see if it worked. Right? You know, I'm that kind of guy. Right? I am absolutely that kind of guy. I'm the kind of guy that if I start doing meth and I don't have any, I'll chop up a Tylenol and see if it works. Right? You know, I'm kind of way out there like that. But, you know, so I'm 8 years old, 10 years old. I started running around. We lived in West Covina. I was going to be going to Nogales High School. I don't know if anyone knows about Nogales High School, but for a white kid like me, it's not the smartest thing to do. And my dad said, we're going to move, right? So we moved to San Dimas, right? It sounds so nice. San Dimas, right? It's like the home of Bill and Ted. And although I did get really upset when they got rid of the Circle K, right? That was the only thing we got out of the whole deal. But so we moved to San Dimas, see? And what happens for a guy like me is you can move me anywhere you want. I'm going to look for the people that are like me. See, and I'm a young kid. I'm 12, 13, 14 years old, and we're stealing and doing whatever we can do to get that drink, right? And the drink becomes that important. And I get into high school, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm not stupid, right? Most of us are pretty intelligent people, right? We know how to manipulate the system, do whatever we need to do. And I'm a high school kid. I'm drinking and I'm partying and I'm doing all those things that I want to do. But I know that that I need to toe the line with my family, right? And my dad wants me to be a football player, a baseball player, all those kind of things. Now, I'm pretty intelligent when it comes to this kind of stuff. And I know that if I'm playing football and I'm playing baseball and I'm active in school, then he's not going to pay attention to what I'm doing over here, right? See, so I lived that double life all through high school, right? And I'm a freshman in high school, and everybody's, you know, we're going to high school parties, and we're doing all that kind of stuff. And the basketball team made it to a CIF, right? So this is supposed to be like some big deal. And it's like 10 o'clock in the morning one day, someone says, hey, you want to go to a party? And I'm like, yeah. Right? They said, okay, jump the fence, hop in the car, and we're going, right? So I hopped the fence, we jumped in the car, and we went to San Dimas Canyon. And as we're up there in San Dimas Canyon, we're at the stables, right? And the party's going. Party's going. I don't remember if there were kegs or it was just beer cans. And you know what? I got to tell you, they should never put the phone to your wrist. Because when the phone rings, your wrist rings, and it's really weird. But it's not my wife. So it's the truth, right? I'm sitting here and like my wrist is going, like, Jesus criminy. So we're up in San Dimas Canyon and we're having a party, right? And it's a good party. Everything's going real well. And then all of a sudden somebody yells, the cops are here, right? Yeah. And I'm sitting there and I'm partying with all these people. I'm the youngest one at the party. And all of a sudden they're freaking out, right? These people are ditching their beers, putting the bottles down. They're putting bottles down. Now, like I said, I'm alcoholic. I'm not an idiot. I know if the cops are there, that means the party's going to be over quickly, right? So they would put them down, and I would pick them up. They would put it down, I would pick it up, and that's how I went through, right? And by the time the cops got inside, I was trashed, absolutely trashed, right? And everybody, they're talking to everybody, and they tell us, oh, we're going back to school, and yada, yada, yada. And I tell you the story because it's really who I am when I drink and I do the things that I do, right? So they put, there's probably 30 kids, and they start cramming us into sheriff's cars, right? And they got like six kids piled into the sheriff's cars going back to the school. And then the last car, there's only one kid. And out of all those kids that were there, only one kid ended up in handcuffs. Because only one kid decided it was time to discuss the situation with the police. And that kid was me. Right? And I went back to school that day. And what happened is we all go inside. Everybody's lining up and everyone's depressed, right? They all got their heads down. They're in trouble, yada, yada, yada. Right? I get out of that last car and I got my head back. I am so proud, man. Look at me, dude. Look at me. See, because I'm always doing that look at me thing, right? I'm the man, I'm the guy, right? And so I walk in and I'm all proud of myself. And they sit me down and then my baseball coach walks by. Now, mind you, I'm a freshman in high school. My baseball coach walks by and he says, Robbie, are you done ditching school and getting drunk? And I looked at him and I said, I don't know, coach, I'm going to go home, have a beer and I'll think about it. And he informed me that I was no longer a baseball player, and which was fine, I guess. But what happened is that you know, my parents started seeing those things, and those things all started kind of happening, and things started getting crazier and crazier. And my drinking and my using and all those things started getting a lot more crazy, right? I graduated high school by the skin of my teeth. Literally, I got extra credit on the last senior day of high school, delivering library books for my history teacher to the library to get those extra points so I could graduate. Funny part about that is flash forward in my life, and one day I got sober and I'm at a recovery house, and the manager of the recovery house, and up the driveway walks my history teacher with his son, and he's bringing his son to put him into the house, and I'm the guy that's there to greet him, and all he says is, "Oh my God, Robbie Badar," and I'm like, "Yes, sir, Mr. Gobby, you don't worry. I got him. I'll take care of him just the way you took care of me, buddy." Right? Just the way you took care of me. And his son's still sober today, thank God, you know. But thank God. So I make it through high school, right? And then the wheels kind of fall off. I start out a career. I got the girlfriend. I got, you know, I get a job. I'm working on race cars. I got every kid's dream, right? And the drink took it all away. The drink took it all away. And like Danny was saying, I started getting busted, right? You know, I start getting busted and I start going to jail and I start doing all those crazy things that people like me do. And I remember I'm running around, I'm on the streets, I'm no longer welcome at my parents' house because of the things that I'm doing. I guess I should have told you guys earlier, but I'm an entrepreneur, right? So like I'm out trying to sell things, make money, I'm doing all those different things. And I had this grand idea that I could do all those things out of my parents' house because they would never raid my dad's house, right? Because my dad was a cop. And what I can promise you today is that they don't care who your dad is. They will come to the house, right? They will absolutely come to the house. So I was no longer welcome at home. And I was doing all those different things that were just crazy, just absolutely crazy. And not proud of them today because, you know what, there were times where my dad had to tell my little sisters, you know what, if your brother comes around, you're not allowed to go with him. And my dad had to tell people in the neighborhood, if you see my son, don't call me, call the police. Right? And that's one more of those things that makes that spring in your stomach just tighten up a little bit more. Just a little bit more, right? And so I start getting arrested. I'm 20. I start getting arrested. And I get busted quite a few times in Covina and San Dimas, all over the area, right? And it's just really, really putting shame on my family, you know? I can't imagine the kind of pain that my dad was feeling, you know, because my dad was a homicide investigator for the LAPD, right? And he was very well respected in his career. And he would tell me things like, son, you know what, I get called out, and my biggest fear is that I'm going to get there and it's going to be you. See, and I had absolutely no empathy, and I would say things back to him like, you don't have to worry, I don't party in LA. Right? just absolutely heartless, right? Just absolutely heartless. No feeling, no emotion, no anything. And see, and I get busted the first time, and I go to West Covina to court, and my dad showed up. And I'm in there, and I go through the little process, and I end up getting probation. They send me on my way, and I'm walking out of that courtroom, and my dad says, "Son, you need to quit doing what you're doing. You need to turn your life around." And I paid him no mind. I said some smart-ass comment to him, and I walked away. Now, I left that day, and I went to a hotel right there on Restaurant Row in Covina. And by the end of the night, West Covina's SWAT team had taken me into custody. So a day or two later, I'm in front of that same judge in West Covina court, and the judge says, "So, Mr. Badar, I noticed that your father's not in the room today." And that spring one more time tightened up in my gut. See, I had pushed everyone away that cared about me and was doing everything I needed to do to keep the party going. And I thought that I had it going on. I thought I had it going on, right? The things I was doing, we're having fun, right? Everyone that loves me is miserable, but I'm having fun. See, and then I got busted one last time for doing credit card fraud before it was popular. It's back when you like actually had to show up at the store and go in. And so I went in there. I was like 130 pounds. I had glasses that made me look like Poindexter because my head was so small and my glasses were so big. And I went in there and tried to convince these people that I needed credit so that I could buy a computer and all this different stuff for college. And I looked like a tweaker. That didn't go to school, definitely. And they called Covina PD, and Covina PD showed up. And I was smart, right? Because when I'm drinking and I'm doing the things I do, I get real, real intelligent, right? So I'm smart. So I had taken a paper plate and put it over my license plate of my car in the parking lot, right? Because I figured, you know, the paper plate, they'll never be able to get my license when I leave here, right? What it did is it told the cops exactly what car I was running to, right? And the cop goes, "Really? Is that a paper plate?" And I'm like, yeah. But so I'm down. I'm in Covina jail one more time, and I'm down in the holding cell, and this cop comes up, and he taps his key on the window, and he says, "I told you we'd get you again." And pitiful and incomprehensible. Demoralization is exactly what that's called. See, and I go over to court, and I'm on my as I'm in the jail cell at the court. The cop comes up and he's putting my. I told you my dad's a cop, right? So I'm getting special treatment. You know, you're special. And this cop's got me leaned up against the glass and he's putting waist shackles on me and he says, "God, I hope no one ever has to do this to my son." And I would have beat him to a pulp if I had my hands. Or my feet, at that matter. Because pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. Exactly what it talks about, right? So he walks me down to the courtroom, and on the way down there, they say, "You have an attorney visit." And I don't know about any of you people, but I'm a public defender kind of guy, right? And I haven't met a public defender yet that wanted to visit with you when you weren't in the courtroom and they were telling me that I was going to get a good deal. So I went into this attorney visit, and this lady's sitting there, and she obviously was a private attorney, and she picked up the little phone, and she said, "Robbie, I need to let you know that I'm not here for you. I'm a friend of your father's, and you're killing him. You are killing him. And I would love to tell you that that's the spot that everything clicked, but what I heard her say is, I'm a private lawyer, and I'm going to get you out." That's what came through the phone. And so she asked me a question that I hadn't been asked, and she said, "Do you have a problem with drugs and alcohol?" And I said, "Absolutely," right? Because I knew that if I had a problem, that I was getting out, right? Did I believe it? I mean, all the signs were there, but I told her, "Yes, absolutely." It was during Schick Shadle time, right, where they used to pass the candle. I would have held the candle at that point. I was dead serious about getting out of jail. I wasn't dead serious about getting sober or changing my life. See, and I went back into that courtroom that day, and I walked in, and there were two people in court that day, my dad, who had that look a lot of our parents had, or the people that love us, like, where did I go wrong with this kid? Just destroyed, just a shell of a man. And the other one was my youngest sister, and she was in her little Catholic schoolgirl outfit because my parents were convinced that public school was the problem. So my sisters went to Catholic school. Didn't help. Well, it helped. Hey, they're 50-50 on those, right? But so she's sitting there, and she's just in tears because her hero is one more time all locked up. The guy that she looked up to is locked up one more time, all shackled up. And the judge asked me something that day that absolutely changed my life, and I don't know if I was being honest with him or not. He said, "Mr. Bedar, men like you belong in the penitentiary," and that's not a news flash. He said, "But you know what? I'm going to give you a chance here. You're going to go to jail. You need to go to jail. But when you get out, you're going to go into a program, and that's going to keep you from going to prison. But Mr. Bedar, men like you don't make it. And if I see you back in my courtroom, you're going to get every bit of the 6 years you have coming." And I had heard that time and time again from judges, from everybody, right? "Next time, next time, next time." And I said, "Yes, sir." And he sent me off to jail. And I went and I did my little bit of time. And when I got out, I was up north by that point. I like to travel when I drink, right? So when I get in trouble, I go to L.A., then I stop in Ventura, and then I cruise up north a little further, right? It was like a little bus tour in handcuffs. I got to tell you, if you have any doubts about Alcoholics Anonymous, if you're going to continue your deal, go to Northern California, all the way up by Truckee, Nevada County. The facilities are much nicer. Mats are bigger. The coffee's better. All that stuff. I don't recommend the jail. I actually do. I was staying in hotels down here that were worse than that jail. And so I would get in trouble, and I would rush to go tell them how I was violated from up north, right? So this time I get out, and I had this theory about how life was, right? If I got busted and I got out, if my friends hadn't made sure I was taken care of by the time I got to this side of the 605 freeway, they weren't good friends, right? And this time I got out, and I ended up back at my parents' house, and my mom said, "We got a program all set up for you. We're all lined up for you to have a program." I have no idea what time I started.
You okay?
I'm good?
Yes, sir.
The man with the ticket said I'm good. We're good. So I get back down. I go to my mom's house, or my mom and dad. It's my stepmother and my father, but she raised me. She raised me. God bless this woman. She stuck with me when a lot of people wouldn't. And I got to the house, and she said, you can stay tonight, but we got a program for you. And I said, okay, well, I just need to run over to this to take care of a couple things. And I got in my car and I left. And I went over to this woman's house that I was with before I got busted. And I knocked on her door. And a friend of mine answered her door. And which wasn't odd because I had left him there like 6 months earlier. So I figured he should still be there, right? And I said, "Hey, man, where's she at?" And he goes, "Dude, I don't know what you guys talked about before you got busted, but she got sober." And I'm like, "What?" He's like, "Yeah, she checked into a recovery house." I'm like, "Oh my God, I need to go save her." So I rushed over to this woman's facility in Covina, and I ran up and I knocked on the door, and that woman was there, and she came out, and she said, she started telling me how wonderful it was to be sober and how excited she was, and I found out it was a woman's facility, so I figured I need to check in here. This is a good spot, right? And she goes, "No, they have a men's facility, and you can check in there. It'll be great." So I ran home, and I honestly believe God was doing for me what I couldn't do for myself at that point. And he used every character defect that I hold dear, you know, that I probably still hold dear to my heart. I ran in, and I told my mom this, the best line I could give her. "I need to get sober in Covina because that's where, you know, I'm gonna live. So this needs to be where my." You know, I need to build a wall. I gave her every good analogy I could for why I needed to have sobriety in Covina, and I needed a foundation. If I was going to really stay sober, I needed a foundation. It was all crap. Everything I gave her was just for me to get to go see this woman, to get sober with this woman, I promise. And so I fed her this long line, and she's like, "I think that sounds great," right? And she called Carl, who owns the house, and he tells her all the same stuff I had just lied to her about. He told her the truth, right? Like, "Well, you know, it'd be good for him to get a foundation where he's going to live, and we have a great community," and da-da-da-da-da. And she was like, "Wow, he told me the truth, first time in years." And so the next day I was set to go over to that recovery house and I was supposed to check in. And on my way there, I stopped by a buddy's house. And I found out what it talks about in the Book of Alcoholics Anonymous when it says I'm absolutely defenseless. I'm absolutely defenseless against the first drink, period. Right? I go there and I knock on the door. 9 hours later, I leave. And I show up at that recovery house and that woman's still waiting for me. And she says, you missed him. You got to come back tomorrow. And we got in the car. She said, we're going to go to a 5 o'clock meeting at the 502 Club. And I was like, crap, that's the last place I ever wanted to end up. Right. And she was working a program already at that point. So she grabbed a man from the men's facility and they both got in my car and we drove over there. And on the way there, we got in a car accident. And I got these two super sober, happy people in the car and they're like, dude, aren't you glad we're not loaded? And I'm like, yeah, so excited. Right. And I wanted to run. See, I'm a runner, right? The cops are coming, I'm running. And I didn't run that day, and the cops showed up, and I didn't get in trouble that day. And I went home that night, and I cried to a God that I didn't know anything about. And I said, God, why can't I stay out of jail 24 hours without something horrible happening in my life? What is it about the way I'm living that's causing me to live this way? And my prayers were answered the next day. I checked into the recovery house in Covina. I checked into Puente House and they sent me to Alcoholics Anonymous because I was not to be confused about a recovery house being AA. I was told straight out, this is a recovery house, a place where you stay sober, you live sober, you learn how to live sober, but you go get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I rushed down to the club at 6:15 in the morning and they told me, hey, you're going to AA, so you need to tell them you're alcoholic. I'm like, well, you know, I got all that kind of dope fiend pride, right? I'm not alcoholic, right? And so I go down there, and they said, well, you need to identify as alcoholic or the old people get mad. And I said, cool. Went in there. I walked in that morning meeting. They asked for newcomers. I raised my hand. I said, my name's Rob. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm an addict. And I put an emphasis on the addict part. And thank God I did because it did piss them off. And this old man got over and he walked over next to me. And I believe to this very day, he told me the secret to Alcoholics Anonymous that very first meeting that I was sitting there. That man's name was Harvey, and God, I love that old man. That was my old man. And he sat down next to me, and he said, son, you're alcoholic, and that's all you are. If you come in here and you try to be different from all of us, you're going to die drunk. But if you come in here and you look for the similarities instead of the differences, then maybe the program that's working for all of us can work for you. And I was like, damn. Right? And he didn't tell me in those exact words. He knew what I needed to hear and swore me to secrecy that I would never say it from a podium. But he talked in my language and he let me know that my biggest thing was I didn't need to difference myself out of Alcoholics Anonymous. See? And what I found out that day is that old man could care less about how I identified in the meeting. What he cared is that I wouldn't difference myself out of here, right? And that old man wasn't my first sponsor. I got a sponsor because I needed a job. So I got a home group, a job, and a sponsor, all because those were things I had to get when I was living in this recovery house, right? I needed a job. They said people that go to morning meetings have jobs. So I got up and went to the morning meeting. I found a man. He owned a company. Cool. You got some sobriety? Cool. All right. I got a job. I now got a sponsor and a boss. Okay. I'm good, right? So I got a job, a sponsor, all right there, right? And that man didn't stay sober, but he taught me how to do early sobriety. And he got me involved in doing H&I panels and doing all this kind of different stuff and got me really, really involved. And then one day, he was gone. I showed up at a panel and he wasn't there. See, and that man ended up becoming the best example that a guy like me could ever have. See, I saw what he had when he was doing the deal, and then I watched him completely fall apart when he wasn't doing the deal. A guy like me, nothing better than to show me. And he showed me, right? And I ran to that old man. I ran to Harvey and I said, Harv, he's drinking. What do we do? And he gave me one of those real old-timer answers, right? He looked at me and he said, son, you get a new sponsor. And I was like, I thought we were going to put our capes on and go save him. And he was like, nope. So that old man became my sponsor, and he showed me how to do Alcoholics Anonymous. He didn't tell me. He got me involved in AA. And the reason why he got me involved in AA is because he was involved in AA. See, and we ran around doing everything. He got me involved in convention work. He got me involved in all kinds of service work. And I got real busy in Alcoholics Anonymous. And then I remember one day, I thought I was going to be speaking all over the world. And I was going to be doing this. And I was going to do that, right? And I was at an Alcathon at the 502 Club. And a man named Phil Turner walked over to me. And Phil Turner said, "You know, Rob, there's guys in AA that sponsor thousands of people." I'm like, "Yeah, that's going to be me." Right? And he goes, "You know, Rob, there's guys in Alcoholics Anonymous, they speak all over the world." And I'm like, "That's going to be me." Right? And then he handed me a trash bag and he said, "Rob, there's guys like me and you. Go take out the trash." See, but what that man did that day is he taught me a very, very, very vital lesson. He taught me that it doesn't matter how many people you sponsor, it doesn't matter how many times you talk, don't you ever forget to take out the trash. Right? Don't you ever forget to take out the trash. See, and I come from a group that is very active like that. You know, like Danny said, that's what we do. That's what we do. We get involved in Alcoholics Anonymous and we run in a pack because it's a hell of a lot harder to pick us off in a pack, right, than it is trying to do this thing alone. So I really honestly have no idea what time I started. But the sad part about that is I'm 51 and I looked when I started and I still can't remember. But you know what I can tell you really fast is that I've been given a life in Alcoholics Anonymous that's better than anything a guy like me could have ever imagined. I was at a 5 o'clock meeting one day and this girl walked in and everyone was looking at her and I was like, "Oh man." So I ran over to her and I gave her the best AA line I could, right? Because I knew she was new. And I care about what the old guys think. So I ran over there and I said, "You know what, honey? You need to stay sober so one day I can take you out." And let me tell you, that's the cheesiest pickup line ever, right? She looked at me like, "You're an idiot." And we've been married 15 years. And we've been together for 20. I only claim 19 because I couldn't date her till she had a year, right? But if you ask her, we've been together 20 years, so that's her deal, right? But what came with her were these two little girls. She had these two little girls. One of them was 2 and one of them was 3. And those two little girls, they're my life, right? They're both graduating from college this year. Who would think, you know, one alcoholic meets another alcoholic in Alcoholics Anonymous and we can raise a family that actually does something, right? And then the girls, you know, they were everything. I mean, it was just complete, absolutely complete. And my wife came and said, "I want to have a baby." And I was like, "Well, we have, you know, the girls, everything's good, right?" And we went through a real rough patch, right? I didn't want my girls to ever think there was anything more important in my life than them. And I went to my sponsor. I went to Harvey, and I said, "Harv, you know, what do I do?" And he was getting really up there in age. So I went to George and I said, "What do I do?" And he said, you don't need to worry about it. Your love's going to be enough. Your love's going to be enough, right?" And as soon as we found some peace with the fact that we weren't going to be able to have any more kids, right? And as soon as we found some acceptance in that, right? And then she ended up pregnant. And now we have a 10-year-old, right? And he's—I'm really sorry—he's like the spitting image of me, right? Looks just like me, right? Hopefully he doesn't act like me too much, but he looks just like me. And you know what? Tonight, when I was getting suited up and I was getting ready to come up here, my son and my wife were there. My girls, like I said, they're both off in college. My son and my wife were there, and they gave me a hug and a kiss and sent me on my way, you know. And this morning I got to take my 10-year-old son. Right, and you know when you get about 10, right, they don't need you anymore. And I got to take my 10-year-old son. It was Donuts with Your Parents Day at school, right? And we showed up to school, and he grabbed my hand and held my hand walking in there, and I was like, "Man, I could have missed it all. I could have missed it all. You know, one, I could have missed it all. But instead, I get to live an amazing life." You know, and I usually when Mike's in the house, we're not really in the house, but when Mike's here, I tell the story about they thought I should never leave the recovery house. And one day I was in a morning meeting and I was struggling with this. I wanted to move out, and there were people in the house that were like, "You're not moving out, man. Don't leave. You're going to get drunk. Don't leave. Don't leave." So I turned to Mike because he had a hell of a lot more time than anybody that was talking to me. And I said, "Mike, what do you think?" He said, "Hey, you think you're ready? Go." And I was like, "Sweet." So Mike Babb gave me permission. And because of that, I've got to do all this. I've gotten to do all this, right? All this stuff is definitely being overpaid for a guy like me. And I think that's it. All right, thank you.
I'm less alcoholic.
Yes.
Let's give Dan and Rob a hand for a great meeting. You actually brought some stuff back this week. I'm really impressed. We need a lot of help cleaning up afterwards. And I keep saying that if you're going to bring something, we have a board here. And we write it down. So after the meeting, go up and ask Greg. Right? Greg. Oh, tell him what you're going to bring. We could put this deal together because it's a wee deal. And I'm your grapevine rep. I got two back tonight. What we do is we read them, and then we bring them back, and we recircle them. It's meeting in a print, you know. And I always tell you, leave it in a bus stop, a recovery house, send one to a prison, you know, give one to a friend. You never know where you'll get that thought, you know, 1% inspiration, 99% perspiration. You got to take the action. We have H&I meeting the first Monday of every month. If you want to get involved in hospitals and institutions, I strongly suggest you go to the 502 Club on Monday night and get involved. You know, that's what they did to me when I got here. They used to tell me, "Hey, kid, get in the car." where are we going? "Just get in the car." And I'd get in the car, and we'd end up at the hospital or at the insane asylum, and then we started going to the prisons. In those days, you signed up to go to a prison, you can go in all of them. But it isn't that way today. But anyway, 2 years, $58. This one here is the home group. And I strongly suggest if you're new, get yourself a home group. You know, get active, make coffee. That's the best job in the joint. You know, it gets the me and I out of me. You know, that's the whole deal. So, to watch loneliness vanish. Who wants one? Come up and get it. And everybody that's new that came today, welcome home. Tina and Ron, come on up and you could do this.
I'm the one that brought mine back from last
this
week.
This guy. Good. Is that the one you brought? And you could take this one.
There you go.
All right. Thank you. You're welcome.
Tina
and Ron. Where's Ron? The guy
Where
that...
Are you, Ron?
So if you want to get involved in this meeting, we need a lot of help. So if you want to volunteer or you want to get active in this group, see Fernando or me or Greg, and we'll give you something to get. We're looking for. No. Go ahead.
What are we looking for?
I forgot.
I'm Tina. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you so much for participating in your sobriety tonight and showing up and bringing stuff for the meeting. We have some giveaways, and thank you so much for supporting our raffle. And then don't forget to clean up your sobriety station because I'm somehow designated myself as the lost and found, and I took some glasses home last week. Okay, so the last four numbers is 9902. We got some good stuff tonight. 9902. We got a big book, Alcoholics Anonymous study guide.
Oh, wow.
We got a God box, if you want a God box. We got for to deal with our counterpart, the Al-Anon. We have a vintage 24-hour book.
Anybody want something?
A Living Sober.
You coming?
You take this, Art. Take this. That's a blessing right there. It's a study guide. It came from Dick Burgess. Red Fred bought it for him. Yeah.
That's a classic.
That's a classic. You don't want to. You want to hold on to that. You want to hold on to that. Okay. Next ticket.
Next ticket.
9804. 9804. Look at this God box right here.
You know what? I was thinking,
nothing's getting out of here.
You know, I was thinking, take it for my money thing.
Oh. Thank you. What would you like?
Take the little bit.
All right.
Cool.
Thank you. All right. Here we go. Next one. 9842. Come on down. Here, here's a one-on-one AA sponsorship in action. A Living Sober. You want a God box?
Sure. Can we get another ticket?
Put your worries in there and don't take them back.
Okay. Can we get another ticket?
Yeah, pick another ticket.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Keep coming back. Come on, Ron. Hurry up. Let's do this thing. There's an intergroup meeting, by the way, on April 20th at the 502 at 10:30 in the morning. And we hope you're all there. Ron, what's this guy doing? Hey, the fellowship is after the meeting. After the meeting. You do the fellowship after the meeting. Okay. What are you over there flirting?
Yes.
Okay. 9837. 9837. Yeesh. Come on. 9837. Is that you?
97 something.
No, it's not you. It's 989837. Anybody? Going once? Twice? We're done. Okay, one more. We're going to get this thing. Thank you for sharing, by the way. That was a wonderful pitch. 9753. 9753.
Oh, shit.
That's you threw yours away? Oh, well.
Yes.
Pick another one.
Love you, Ron.
Okay. 9848.
I'm buying a lot of
9848.
Yeah. Five.
Come on.
Yeah. Come on down.
The cook.
Great.
The cook.
Put the hand.
Sponsorship? Living Sober?
Sponsorship one sounds good.
All right.
Thank you.
Okay. Are we going to do this thing? Where is he at?
At the end with two.
Okay. Two more. Here, I got two. Okay, now let's pay attention. 9922 and 9938. 9922 and 9938.
I got 9922.
Come on. Come on.
Ready?
Come on. 9938.
Here we go.
Which one do you want?
22.
Living Sober or Al-Anon?
Living Sober.
9938. Oh, I get another classic. All right.
You can donate it to Camp Seeley if you want.
All right. So, no, I got a mom who's got to deal with my ass.
All right. Thank you all for allowing us to be of service, and thank you for participating in your sobriety. Huh? These?
Yes.
We're done. Okay. Keep coming back. Does somebody want to read the promises and pray us out? Mike? There you go. Mike's get sober.
Hey, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Mike.
Mike.
This is the 9-step promises. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past or wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in ourselves. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them. After a moment of silence for all that still suffer, please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. All right, Eric, we'll see you later, bud. Stop. I just stopped.
All right, yeah, I leave that. That's a.